WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me is acoustic guitarist Marty Gross. And one of the things he does is play rhythm guitar, which is an art that I must say nearly died out. His repertoire highlights a lot of obscure jazz and pop tunes from the 1920s and 30s, but as New York Times music critic John S. Wilson has written about him, his music adds to the past instead of just copying it. He's the son of German satiric artist George Gross. He was born in Berlin, came to America with his family in 1933 because his father's work was quite unpopular among the Nazis in Germany. He began playing guitar at age 13 and founded a band with bassist Pops Foster and pianist Dick Wellstead. From 1954 to 1974, he was based in Chicago, where he recorded both under his own name and with pianists Art Hodes and Don Newell. He recorded with folk singer Jim Queskin and with the Dukes of Dixieland. 1975, he went to New York to join Bob Wilbur and Kenny DeVerne's band Soprano Summit. 1979, he appeared at the White House with the New York Repertory Orchestra. Marty Gross has written two booklets for the Time Life Jazz Reissue series, The Jazz Guitars, and a biography of Chicago clarinetist Frankie Teschenmacher. Marty Gross plays regularly, by the way, with Woody Allen at Michael's Pub in New York. He also plays with Dick Melodeon's trio at Hoboken House in New Jersey. You might have also heard him last year on the Prairie Home Companion Show. Well, you can hear him perform this Sunday evening in the opening, well, one of the opening concerts of the Cool Jazz Festival. This concert will take place this Sunday, June 17th, at the Halloran Plaza Hotel in the main ballroom, which is at Route 130 in Pensauken, New Jersey. It's co-sponsored by the Penn Jersey Jazz Friends and the Cool Jazz Festival. He'll be featured in an octet that will also include Bud Freeman, Kenny DeVerne, George Masso, Doc Cheatham, Dick Wellstead, Major Holly, and Butch Miles. For more information, you can call 745-6285. That's 745-6285. Marty Gross, welcome to Fresh Air. I really love your playing, and you brought your guitar with you. Can you open with a song for us?
Tickle of Death. Tickle of Death.
Take me to that land of jazz. Let me hear the kind of blues that Memphis has. I want to step to a tune that's full of ginger and pep. Pick 'em up, lay 'em down. Let me hear that razzmatazz. I want to give you fair warning. I won't be home before morning. Everybody loves a jazz bow in the loving land of jazz. Oh, in that loving land of jazz. Jazz, let me hear the kind of blues Philadelphia has. I want to step to a tune that's full of ginger and pep. Pick 'em up, lay 'em down. Let me hear that razzmatazz. And let me give you fair warning, I won't be home before morning. Everybody loves a jazz bow in the loving land of jazz. Oh, in that loving land of jazz, 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 jazz.
Oh, great. Really terrific. My guest is Marty Gross. Well, you started playing guitar, I think, when you were 13.
Around that time, yeah. Ukulele first.
Uh-huh. You've played a lot of rhythm.
When I was eight.
You've played a lot of rhythm guitar, and once electric guitar came along, I think it displaced a lot of rhythm guitarists. What interested you in that form?
You know, I've been trying to work up an answer to that question for 20 years, and I'm almost got into final form. the first records when I was coming up right around that time, of course, Charlie Christian had come in with the electric guitar with the Benny Goodman Sextet 1940, 39 and 40 was big. Everybody was buying Benny Goodman Sextet records. And at the same time, the Nat Cole Trio had made its first records with Oscar Moore on electric guitar. And all of a sudden, everybody was running out and buying these amps and stuff like that. And I don't know why. I think it's just a perverseness. I just wanted to be different. But I liked what I heard. I remember I had a record of Roy Eldridge and Benny Carter and Coleman Hawkins playing I Can't Believe You're in Love with Me in a pianoless rhythm section. And they had a guitar player named Bernard Addison. And Roy Elwood used to like to have a guy play a shuffle rhythm when he soloed. Like, I think sort of like, I will demonstrate, sort of like... He liked that kind of thing. And so that knocked me out. And then I, at the same time, with little programs coming out of California, which had the great chord guitar stylist George Van Epps on it. And I just, that was the kind of thing that just attracted me. I can't explain it any other way. I thought the other, for some reason, the other thing just never grabbed me, which is kind of strange. It's like going through, oh, the 60s and not liking the Beatles as a young man or something, or not really, not that I disliked Charlie Christian or disliked the electric guitar players, the guy with, who was it with, Artie Shaw's Gramercy Fives, Al Hendrickson. I didn't dislike them, but it just didn't get me emotionally the way these other guys did. And I liked to listen to George Van Epps, Carl Kress, Django Reinhardt, Eddie Condon, and rhythm guys. I used to go to the movie houses, and they'd have big bands, and there'd always be a guy sitting there. And if you listened real close during some of the quiet, the vocals or something, you'd hear ching, 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 and I'd say, wow. And once in a while, I got a little spot, and I thought that was terrific. And I the other thing sounded alien to me for some reason.
Did your friends think you were peculiar?
They thought I was peculiar for many reasons, but not the least of which was, they said, hey, get an amp. And finally, when I was in Chicago later on, I was finally decided, if we're going to make some money, I got to play some of these club dates, and things, club dates, bar mitzvahs, weddings, booster parties for politicians and stuff. And I finally got an amp, and it was like, it was the size of a fireplace. It was like carrying a fireplace around it. In fact, there was one guy I worked with in Chicago who had an electric keyboard, and he had a wagon constructed to push it around with into freight elevators of hotels when he played, and he took up weightlifting just so she could, these speakers, how the rock groups are with these huge columns. Well, this guy was trying to get sounds like that, and I said, well, wait a minute, if I got to do this, and if the sound is going to come out, after all, you hold a guitar in your lap right by your belly, and it comes, the sound comes right up through your body, your head, your nose, your ears, everything like that, and if you use an amp, for some reason the sound comes out 8 feet away wherever the amp is placed. And that struck me as weird, And you can't really play rhythm, ching, 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 with an amp. It doesn't work.
Too much sustain?
Too much sustain. It always sounds oop, 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 oop. It always hangs over too long, and the notes run into each other. And you don't get the pick sound, which is the percussive sound of the guitar. So anyway, that's what...
You taught yourself. What gave you a lot of trouble when you were learning?
Everything. What gave me trouble was, I remember I used to put on the slowest records I had. I think the slowest record I had was Mood Indigo by Duke Ellington. It was on the jukeboxes for 40 years. It was like, whoo, blunk, blunk, blunk. And I used to practice along with that B-flat, C-shift, C-7th, ding, ding. And then all of a sudden, the next two, it had two changes in one bar, and that was too much. I'd have to take the record off and practice it over and over again. But I think I picked wrong. I held the pick in the wrong way. I used my thumb on the fingerboard, which is also not recommended if you're, in classical training and so forth. Those, I've heard marvelous guitar players who do use their thumbs and who do pick all wrong, and they somehow manage to get away with it. But I did many of those things wrong. And you keep a style. You have an individuality when you're self-taught. Like, I think many of the great jazz musicians, I don't want to arbitrarily put myself elevate myself into their ranks by saying, yeah, me, I'm self-taught too. There are a lot of self-taught guys who are terrible. But some of the great stylists, Teagarden, Coleman Hawkins, Sidney Bechet, Louis Armstrong, were more or less self-taught guys. And what you do is you get character out of it and individuality. The teacher doesn't knock it out of you. Not that I would, if anybody's listening who's taking lessons, I don't want to disabuse them. I think it's great to have lessons too. But I think there's a fundamental difference between the kind of jazz player, usually fundamental difference between the one who is first, we're very accomplished, and then comes to jazz, and then discovers jazz. There's a big difference between that and the one who plays jazz, picks up an instrument in order to play jazz. The other one has usually a better finish technique and read better and everything like that. But the one who does it out of passion, is the one that seems to have more guts in his style and more feeling, I think.
When you learned that you were doing certain things the incorrect way, did you try to change them or did you just say, well, who cares?
Yes, I did change them. It was very painful. I changed them while I was playing full time. And you make you keep making the same mistakes. You have to have time off to change. You have to not be playing for a month. And then, if you're a trumpet player and you have a new embouchure, in my case, when I wanted to stop using my thumb because it basically cramps the hand. It's much better this way. And I had an awful time because I'd always fall back into the old bad habits in combat conditions, namely when you're playing in a saloon, you fall back into your old bad habits.
What do you do now?
What do I do now?
Which way do you play it?
I don't use the thumb. I hold the pick in the Van Epps approved George Van Epps method. I try to do it more or less. Some of the things prove to be sound principles.
You have two albums of guitar duets with Wayne Wright.
Right.
I'd like to play one of those so we can hear some more of your playing. There's a long tradition of guitar duets in jazz. Tell us why you decided to do this duet with him and some of the other pairs that you had in mind when you got together.
Oh, well, I always liked guitar duets. Ever since Dick Wellstead, when I was about 18, gave me a record that he discarded of. I think it was Stage Fright and Having a Heat Wave by Carl Kress and Dick McDonough. And he said, "Well, you want this thing?" He was heavy into sort of a New Orleans thing at that time, and this was sort of too studio slick for him, I think, the feeling of it, or too. Maybe a little bit contrived, and he gave this. He doesn't even remember this, but he gave it to me, and I took it home and played it. I said, "Wow!" I said, "Those guys can really play, and all kinds of things are happening with two. They have lines going different directions and so forth." And I think it started from there. And then all my life long, I'd wanted to. I enjoyed the work of Carl Kress and Dick McDonough. I thought they were two jazz guitar pioneers, and I always enjoyed that kind of thing. And so when I got a chance, I somehow tried to put guitar duets together. I had a friend in Chicago, and we played things. And then with Wayne, I played things. And through the years, I've found guys, it's interesting to trade ideas. It also gives you, when there are dry spells in your career, it gives you some, you go to each other's houses and work out things, and it's good for your chops,
Okay, well, let's hear Goody Goody with you and Wayne Wright. And this is you opening up the record, right?
I conceived the arrangement of it, then he plays the melody. Usually my function is that of, if you can compare it to a piano, of a left hand. I'm the rhythm guy, and I play the bass notes, and he usually does the single note things. And when there's a chord solo, it's me.
Okay, let's hear it. Goody Goody with my guest Marty Gross on guitar, along with guitarist Wayne Wright. Thank you. Goody Goody with my guest Marty Gross on guitar, along with guitarist Wayne Wright, from an album also called Goody Goody on the Aviva record label. You were just telling me as we were listening to that that it's a really different feeling when you're playing with an amplified guitar in a band than it is when you're playing acoustic.
Yeah, generally speaking, if the louder the music and the louder the amps, like with the rock groups, that music goes out and reaches out and throttles the audience. Reaches into them and pulls at them. When you're playing acoustic strings, guitar, violin, or something like that, everybody has to quiet down, and you can draw them into you. That's really the point of it, to me. You know, music can't all be loud and always up. It's got to be a moment when it all comes down, and I must have contrast. And in the old days, that's what guitars and violins and to some extent piano solos used to do. Everybody in the orchestra had to quiet down to listen, give them their moment, and then they could go back to riffing and roaring, you know.
You moved to America when you were three. You emigrated with your family from Germany. Your father was the artist George Gross, who was looked upon kindly. By the Nazis. Do you remember anything about that? You were pretty.
Remember coming over on the Bremen, and I remember that when we were near New York, they sent off a catapult plane with the airmail. That was airmail in those days. They got about 200 miles from New York, and they sent the mail in with a catapult plane. But that's neither hither nor thither. We settled in New York, and then soon after that in Long Island, in Queens, and it was just like. I grew up like any other kid, so sort of, you know, except that I could speak two languages.
So you weren't very aware then of the dangers that lay ahead in Germany?
It didn't take long. I mean, when you're 3 years old, it's a little hard to comprehend all that stuff. When you get to be about six or seven, around that time it became apparent. We were a way station for all kinds of refugees coming, friends that had to get out, you know, and my father was busy signing affidavits for them and stuff like that, and we always had them in the house, and there were long political discussions going on into the night, you know, and then, of course, when the Germans annexed the Sudetenland and all that kind of stuff, it became an Austria and so forth, you know, when that business started happening. Well, then you heard about it in school, too, and the sentiment was not pro, and then it became apparent, you know.
Since your father was an artist, did you ever consider rebelling by becoming a real estate broker?
No, I rebelled by becoming a musician. I had a lot of talent in the visual arts, and I could drawing came very naturally to me, and would have been very easy. But from the time I was 3 years old, they were patting me on the head and saying, "Oh, just like his father," you know. And you can't. I couldn't figure out how to do it, you know. And then when I was a teenager, he was just becoming had his picture in Life magazine and Look magazine and Time magazine and all that kind of stuff. And the kids at school saying, "Jesus, oh, your pop, gosh, that's your dad, gee whiz," and all that stuff. "Yeah, he's famous," and all that stuff. And I said, "What am I going to do?" And I liked jazz music, and I decided that was another way to go. I would never have rebelled by becoming a real estate agent. Accountant or something. I suppose people do. Sure, I suppose there are guys whose parents are live the bohemian zany life, and they become straight, you know.
I should mention that you've designed a lot of the you've done the graphics for a lot of the
I enjoy
album
that, yeah.
Covers,
but never in the style. I do mostly collage and stuff, which is fun with the paste pot and the scissors. I enjoy that.
Did your father listen to much jazz when you were a kid?
Yes. He didn't. At that time, you heard it on the radio. I mean, jazz came via Benny Goodman's orchestra and via Duke Ellington's orchestra over the radio. I don't think during the 30s he went to many clubs. But he did go up to Harlem. He had a cartoonist friend. He used to do cartoons for Esquire, who took him up to Harlem. And he once told me about being at a party this has got to be 32 or so, where Gershwin was there and fell asleep in his chair, and they just all carried the chair out and deposited Gershwin sleeping in the next room and rolled up the carpets and proceeded to have somebody played some dance music. It might very well have been somebody like Willie the Lion Smith, because, you know, we know that these people played at private parties and so forth. So, yeah, and when I was a teenager, then he really got, he used to go bring the bottle of wine up to my room, the old Gallo brothers, and a couple of those Stogies, and he'd lie on my bed. He'd make himself comfortable, get the pillows propped up, and say, "Matt, have a glass of wine here, and now spiel some of those records." And I'd play him things, Louis Armstrong, whatever, Fats Waller, Jerry Benny Goodman, and he loved it. He's, "Oh, beautiful, oh, terrific, boy, oh, boy." You know, he really liked it.
A lot of the songs that you do play are fairly obscure songs from the 20s and 30s. Did you find most of the songs when you were young, or do you still like know where to look to find songs that
you know what I did? You know what I did when I was on the one thing I did when I was on the road. First of all, certain songs just grab you. You hear them once and you like them.
Yeah.
And you say, "Gee, one of these days I'm going to lay that song under contribution." The other thing is when I was playing on the road with various little bands, and I'd wind up in Fort Wayne, Ohio, Toledo, whatever it was, there was always some kind of a junction. There was nothing to do all day. And so there's always some kind of, I remember playing an auto show in Toledo a couple of weeks or something, a week. And so you walk around down, you know, and finally you come to these secondhand little Salvation Army stores and stuff, and there's magazines and old National, you know the stuff. And there'd always be a pile of old sheet music, nickel a copy. And I would just sometimes buy this stuff just for the covers. They were so funny, amusing, you know. And sometimes I'd find something there. I'd look at it. Hey, it's a nice song. But usually what happens nowadays is I get people to send me tapes. The entire output of Mildred Bailey, the entire output of Ivy Anderson, the entire output of send me as much as you have on Tempo King. See if there's a song there. English band, whatever it is. And usually lurking out of 10 things that are hack songs, there's usually one that has a certain something that you might be able to use.
Can you describe what that certain something is that appeals to you in a song?
Well, of course, boy, that's hard. There's a certain felicitous message or a twist of phrase or an interesting harmonic sequence that you don't usually find. Because there's a lot of hack music written. I mean, during the swing era, there were 10,000 riff. If there was one, there were 10,000 riff tunes. You know, do da 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 da, do da 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 da, do da 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 da, boo boo wah, boo boo wah. You know, those kinds. There are thousands of them. Instrumental, some with words. You know, that kind of stuff. And every once in a while, somebody did something a little more ingenious. And I think that's what strikes me.
Okay. Mm. Well, let's listen to another selection from one of your recordings. We're going to hear You Are My Lucky Star, which this is an ensemble piece. I thought it would be fun to hear you in an ensemble setting. Do you want to say a little bit about the recording or the session, anything?
Well, the recording was done at a little studio, and it was hard. We had to redo it because the studio was so dead in a certain way, and it was just four of us. This was just four of out of a bigger group. This is four of us, just the bass, guitar, trumpet and clarinet, and we wanted to do some things with the eight-piece, the octet, and some things with the smaller group. And so this one we picked because Jimmy Maxwell liked to do it, and he is a big Louis Armstrong fan, and Louis Armstrong had done "You Are My Lucky Star," and that's how we came upon this. This is from some movie of 1935 or something. The song.
Okay, and this features a small group led by Marty Gross, and the song is You Are My Lucky Star, and I'll remind you that Marty Gross will be featured in an octet led by Bud Freeman this Sunday evening at the Halloran Plaza in Pennsauken, New Jersey, as part of the Cool Jazz Festival. So here we go.
Thank you.
You Are My Lucky Star, in a session led by my guest, guitarist Marty Gross. You went to Chicago when you were still a teenager, I guess.
18 for the first time.
You were 18. What was left of the jazz scene? What year was that?
Not too much. It was really a romantic quest. At that time, I was very taken with the Chicago players, Condon and Bud Freeman and Floyd O'Brien and who was somebody, Joe Sullivan and stuff. Of course, they left. Either the last one, really, the last important ones to leave Chicago for New York were Wetling and the Marsala brothers around 1935, 36, they came to New York. So too many of them weren't there. But they were. It was still fun because we used to go then, we used to be able to go up to 35th and State where Jimmy Yancey, the boogie-woogie sort of player, had a delightful, airy style, and he used to have, they used to have rent parties there all the time. And all the guys who were in town would fall by. And that was a good experience. And his wife sang, Mama Yancey. They wanted to sing the blues, but she didn't like to. She wanted to sing songs like I'm Gonna Sit Right Down, Write Myself a Letter, and Sin to Tell a Lie. She liked me because I could play those songs, because Jimmy could only really play blues. That's all he was into. But Albert Ammons would come up and knock the piano down, and his son Jug Ammons would come and play the tenor, and Don Yule was in town then, and various guests would drop in. That was kind of a side of life I hadn't experienced. So that part of it was fun. And I ran into some guys, you know, there were still some guys there. Jim Lanigan, the bass player who had played on the original 1927 records with McKenzie and Condon Chicagoans, was there after having played in the symphony. He was gigging around, and I managed to organize a few little concerts with some of the guys that were left. Once Gene Krupa came in and sat in with us, he was playing in town and with all his old cronies, so it was nice. But then I settled there, and I was there for almost 20 years. And I tried everything. I had a band. I tried to put on jazz concerts. I put on concerts and nobody came. And did this and did that. I had a guitar duet, and I had a band on a Just Jazz series on their FM, their public, you know, educational television, Channel 11. And I played 5 years off and on in the Gaslight Club. That was an education. Plucking the banjo, and every night was New Year's Eve, and the customers would bang on the tables with little mallets, and oh boy.
Why'd you go to Chicago? Because after all, New York was at that time.
I wanted to get away
from
home.
The center of the jazz scene.
I just wanted to go someplace. I had Wunderlust. You know, I was out of high school, and I said, friend and I, we had $5 in our pockets, and we hitchhiked, and we were going to go out to the West Coast, just the way you do when you're young. You know, let's go someplace. Let's do something. And let's, yeah, I don't want to hang around here, you know. And they'll want me to get a job, and they'll want me to mow the lawn, or they'll want me to join the yacht, whatever the parents do, you know, all those things. And they want me always to don't hang around the house, or do hang around the house, or whatever it is. So we split, and we got as far as Chicago. We ran out of gas in Chicago, ran out of money, rather, hitchhiking, and stayed there. And I stayed there, and I got some little jobs and work, and before you know it, you're settled.
One of the problems of playing material that comes from another period is that I think a lot of people expect, like, a costume party and expect, you know, that, like, nostalgia, and, you know, that you'll be dressed in the period.
Oh,
and
yeah,
They can make certain demands of, like, their favorites from that period, too, which might not be your favorites. Have you ever gotten trapped with an audience that didn't see the period in quite the way you did?
Yes. If, for example, the Gaslight Club's Inc., they would always have put you in a striped shirt and sleeve garters, and they wanted that. They called it the Roaring Twenties, but they weren't. They were dressed us up like we're in an 1890s beer garden, and that was sort of has become a cliche. And if you look at any pictures of the 20s, they're not wearing striped shirts. They're not wearing straw hats and derbies and stuff. They're usually dressed in tuxedos 90% of the time, sometimes in some other goofy, you know, golf clothes or something, plus fours, if they're doing a theater presentation and so forth. But for dancing, for playing a dance job in those days or in a saloon, you wore a tuxedo. So, they did expect some of the trappings of that. And I know there are people who sell an era. You bring the 20s dance band into your home, and the guy's got an old fashioned microphone, and he's got the band sings through megaphones, you know, group vocals, and they make it look old. But the thing about most of the jazz repertoire is it really hasn't. You go to a jazz concert or you go to a jazz club where mainstream players are playing, and you'll be surprised they're playing Lady Be Good in a mellotone. They're playing songs that are all 40, 50, 60 years old. Sunny Side of the Street, whatever it is. Stardust, Body and Soul. And then once in a while they add a few new ballads. There haven't been too many new rhythm songs that come along. They're still playing Undecided. Things like that, you know, or how old is Cherokee? My God, even that's 1938 or something, 39. So yeah, that's where the material comes. Yeah, I don't think the jazz players, they try to make fusion music and try to adopt, you know, rock, put rock rhythms in and play some of those newer songs. And it's different. I don't know if I don't know if it really is 100% successful.
Do you have any idea why people expect you to wear the straw hat and the striped shirt and the garters? I've never understood that.
I think it's a cheap, accessible uniform. Everybody has some kind of a goofy striped shirt in his closet. They supply the garters and the straw hats, and that's sort of associated with outdoor picnic fun music, I guess, in their heads. I don't really understand it.
You don't know where it comes from, though.
I've eschewed it of late. I've tried both by action and by admonition to get away from it as much as possible. You know, I try once in a while. The guy comes along and he says, listen, it pays enough money. It's only a half an hour. It's a little promotion thing for some company. Do me a favor. You know, you got a vest, put it on or something. If you got a bow tie, put a goofy bow tie on. And if I can remain anonymous and nobody knows me, I might do it and take the money. But otherwise, if it's going to be a public advertised appearance, no.
Right. My guest is guitarist Marty Gross. Could you perform another song for us?
I'd be tickled to death. Did I say that before, didn't I? Can't be tickled to death twice because you wouldn't be alive the second time, right? Okay. This is one of the nicer songs that Fats Waller, he wrote many nice songs, but this is one of the ones that Fats obviously wrote in 10 minutes. The releases, the middle parts are often all the same, and I've examined them at length because we were once going to do an album of all, you know, different Fats Waller material. But this is one of the ones that he really spent a little thought on, and it's one of the ones that never... For some reason, spends thought, time on it, never got big. Never went anywhere for him. But it's a pretty, pretty thing. It's called Lonesome Me. Lonesome Me. With no one to love, lonesome me, neath the moon above. Everywhere lovers all around me. Is it fair that no one has ever found me? I've got arms empty night and day. I've got charms. Will they waste away, waste away, waste away? I'll just go on dreaming, waiting patiently for the one meant for lonesome me.
I've got on empty night and day. I've got charms, will they waste away, waste away? I'll just go on dreaming, waiting patiently for the one meant for lonesome me.
Oh, great. Thanks for playing that. Did you always sing?
No.
How'd you start doing it?
I was working with a band in Chicago, and I used, where was it? I can't remember the club now. Brass Rail, Preview, some one of those joints. And we were backstage, and I used to do this kind of thing backstage. You know, do-do-do-do, doing intermissions, just sit back there, you know. Do-do-do, love is just around the corner. Do-do-do-do, any cozy little call, do-da-do. Like that, and the guys would say, hey, the leader says, why don't you do that out there? We need all the help we can get. And I said, oh, gosh, I was all shook up, nervous, knees knocking, and I honest to God, never had done that. And finally I got up the nerve, you know, late at night after fortifying myself, and finally got up the nerve to do it, and I didn't like it very well, but they kept at it. And they said, no, it sounds good. And I said, oh, geez, sounds terrible, you know. And at that time my voice was a little higher than it is now, and if anybody ever had a recorded it or something, it sounded, you know, like that, and very nasal and stuff. And I, oh, geez, that's no good. But they kept at it, and we kicked it around. And finally, I found out that it was a definite asset. In you did that, and the whoever was paying the bill for the band said, yeah, that's good. Keep him on the band. You know, he's do we need that? You know, and so I started learning words to things all the way through. Before I just know eight bars and then, you know, hum and strum the rest of the way through. So that's how that happened.
I think audiences develop a more intimate relationship with the singer.
It certainly isn't absolutely necessary if you're going to play any kind of obscure tune.
Oh.
If you're going to play if I sit there and let me think of this tune now. Like you say, well, what's that? That's all right. You know, what is that? What does that all mean? But if I say, sweet and slow, rock by me to and fro, while the band is moaning low, honey, take your time. You see, all of a sudden, it has a meaning. The rest of the time, it's sort of like Muzak. You know, it's piped in, but you say, gee, I think I've heard that someplace, but what is it? You know, but the minute you do that, all of a sudden people, oh, yeah, hey, I like that song. And it's only fair, actually, in one sense, it's only fair to the people who spend time in the smoke-filled rooms, you know, putting together the lyrics.
Did you find you were more shy about your singing than you were about your guitar playing? I'm making a presumption of shyness.
I think I had the rhythm thing down pretty good. But I still consider myself a 90% a rhythm guitar player, but I had the solo thing down not at all good. I just wouldn't take solos the first 10 years of my career or something. I just said, no, I'm a rhythm player, and that's it, you know. And I just neglected that part of my education. But now so they were both difficult. The singing thing, I was always embarrassed to do it in front of any real pros, you know, a Jack Teagarden or somebody like that. I'm not going to. That's it. You know, some other time perhaps.
You take terrific solos, and you do a lot of chorded solos.
That's right.
Freddie Green hardly ever soloed, didn't he?
Once on a 1938 record of Dinah. By a group called Pee Wee Russell's Rhythm Makers. He has a 16-bar solo. That's the only one. And he has a little diddly pump or something on a Count Basie rhythm section thing where he just, I don't know, does, you know, something like that. Just a little thing, a little passage, you know, one bar. But real solo, no.
Well, he was a great rhythm guitarist for the Count Basie band. Why didn't he solo?
You have to ask him. I don't know.
I mean, is it part of the tradition of the rhythm guitarist that you don't solo?
Part of the big band tradition that in those days they didn't have microphones and they didn't have amplification, so that they just couldn't. You know, you couldn't hear it. I think Benny Goodman, or this big band record, had when the marvelous rhythm guitar player Alan Roos was with him. Now, he could take solos. He was George Van Epps' star pupil. And he's only a couple of records that where he's allowed even a chorus or something. And it just in a dance hall, you couldn't hear it. It was as simple as that. And most of those guys who grew up in that era, they want the rhythm guitar unamplified, and they want it in there, and it's not there for that purpose, really. But I don't know. I don't imagine Freddie Green is a single string wizard of any kind. You know, I just don't think he set his cap for that.
Well, if rhythm guitarists didn't really solo much, that means you had to develop a way of soloing.
There were some, well, there were other than the chord stylists, like the foremost of whom nowadays still alive is George Van Epps. But then there was Dick McDonough, let me think, Carl Kress, Roos, several of those guys. And they did show a way to do, you know, to sort of combine it with chord. I always liked that. That's just an idiosyncrasy. I love to listen to Django and to Joe Pass and people like that. But I just figure they have a feeling for that I don't. I think it's, if you want to say it's, I have a feeling for a different thing. It's just simple as that. You know, life is short. You can't do everything, except if you're a Joe Pass or an Art Tatum. There are a few who can do almost virtually everything. But
we left you in an earlier part of the conversation in Chicago. We talked about how you got to Chicago and some of your experiences there. But you moved from Chicago back to New York after about 20 years in Chicago.
Roughly, yeah.
Well, you told us why you went to Chicago and why you stayed. Why'd you leave and go back to
New York? I was playing a job at a bank, a Chicago First Savings or something, Riverside Savings, that was the name of the outfit, with a trio. And we were dressed in the aforementioned striped shirts, and to which the people who did the PR for the bank had added a propeller beanie for each of us. And they wanted us to wear shorts. And I said, no, come on now, with the hairy legs and everything like that. We're all middle-aged cats here. What are you building? And we got out of that, and we had to play every 10 minutes, so we had to play whatever we were playing, stop it and play Down by the Riverside, because that was their theme, Riverside Savings Bank. And they had girls dressed up as Scarlett O'Hara passing out brochures, you see. Riverside Savings, that was it. And at that point, I was ready to take up I was looking in the back of the magazines and was going to go join the Milwaukee School of Meat Cutters or the DeVry Technical Institute or get in on the ground floor of Diesel, you know, one of those things. And just then I got a phone call from Bob Wilbur, and he said, listen, we've got this group, Soprano Summit. We made one record in New York, and we want to take it out on the road, and we got some jobs, and wonder we have to, you know, for economical reasons, we can't use a piano. We decided it's better to go without piano, just bass, drums, and guitar, and the two horns. Would you like to do it? And I didn't say it, but if I had been in showbiz, I would have said, he said, look back over your shoulder. You see that guy coming down the drive? That's me, you know. But it was that feeling. I said, I got to take the chance. It's much nicer to come back to town. Kenny DeVern, of course, who's going to be in this concert, was both of them had the band. I shouldn't just say Wilbur, because Kenny was instrumental in it too. And it's much nicer than coming back and saying, can I sit in, fellas? Hey, I play guitar, fellas, you know, and was trying to get jobs. Much better to come in. Within 2 weeks of being called by them, I was in Carnegie. I had my foot on a chair in Carnegie Hall, and I was singing Sweet Substitute and Meilenberg Joys in a concert they had devoted to the music of Jelly Roll Morton with George DeVivier and all these guys, you know, Bob Rosengarten and Dick Hyman on the piano. I said, wow. So that's the difference.
Well, that's our cue. Why don't we listen to one of the recordings that you made in Soprano Summit, and we're going to hear you playing and singing How Can You Face Me. Want to say anything about it?
Well, I think I wrote the little what little arrangement there is, I think I put together. That's about all I can think. I really can't remember this record. Did we ever? Well,
you'll hear it. We'll find out. Okay. My guest, Marty Gross on guitar in the Soprano Summit recording of How Can You Face Me. Thank you.
can you face me after what I've gone through? All on account of you tearing my heart in two. Have you no conscience? How could you be so bold? Why have you grown so cold after the lies you've told? No one now seems to be on the level. Since I found that my angel is just a lying devil. Why do I love you? Why did you teach me how? Then you went and broke each vow. Ooh, how can you face me now? Was just a lying devil. Why do I love you? Why did you teach me how? After you broke each vow, oh, how can you face me? How can you stand it? How can you face me now?
How Can You Face Me, recorded by Soprano Summit with my guest Marty Gross on guitar and vocals. One of the things that you've been doing now is playing Monday evenings with Woody Allen at Michael's Pub in New York. Woody Allen plays clarinet in the band. What's it like to play with him? I imagine a lot of people come wanting to see
They come wanting to touch the mantle. They come wanting to bask in the refulgence of Woody Allen. I don't think they understand at all what the music is about. I don't think one of them cares a jot or a tittle for his clarinet playing. I think it's just to be there, and they flock into the joint, and Woody plays New Orleans clarinet. He plays things like "Take My Hand, Precious Lord," "Lead Me On, O Savior," you know, hymns in jazz. He plays what kind of that sort of repertoire, you know, George Lewis, New Orleans type repertoire. And he's very diffident. He's not at all. I think all his humor comes out in his scripts and in his films, you know, and in his acting off the camera and off stage. He's absolutely taciturn, absolute diffident. He doesn't make any remarks like, "Yeah, sounds good," or "Boy, we swinging now." Nothing of that. Just sits there with his shirt, with his elbows coming out of the sleeves, and his famous sneakers, and some kind of wash pants, you know, and plays. It must be therapy for him, in a sense. Plays because, you know, the horn is the therapy and stuff, and that's it. That's about all. It's very strange.
Is he any good?
Well, You know, he does that New Orleans. He gets in a very authentic sort of very woody sound with that New Orleans vibrato, very much George Lewis-y or the kind of thing that Acker Bilk turned into a lot of money. You know,
Okay, we have time for another song. If you'd be willing to play it, I'd love to hear it.
One more song. This one was written by Walter Donaldson. It's about a guy who couldn't play any melodies. All he could play was chord changes, and it goes something like this.
Changes, changes, that's all he can play. Strangers, changes, he plays them all day. So sweet, so I repeat. Changes, changes, just hear while I say. He plays those beautiful changes in different keys. Beautiful changes and harmonies. He starts in C and changes to D. He's messing around most any old key. What's that? Hear that minor strain. That's it, there it goes again. Why there's so many babies that he can't squeeze, but he's always changing those keys. First change into B, change into D, change into E, as easy as the weatherman. Folks, he's getting kind of cold, getting kind of hot. Listen, I forgot, since he was a tot, he's been the talk of Dixieland. Changes in different keys. Beautiful changes and harmonies. He starts in C and changes to D. He's messing around most any old key. What's that? Hear that minor strain. That's it, there it goes again. Why there's so many babies that he can squeeze, but he's always changing. He's rearranging. He's always changing those keys.
Oh, great. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed your music and hearing you play today and talking with you. Thanks so much, and thanks especially for playing for us. It's really been wonderful.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks a million.